paradox, what would be a paradox to the rational mind. Paradox. Perfect, not perfect. If you buy the reality of your human heart, which empathizes, it's sure not perfect. If you go up, it's perfect. So wouldn't you rather stay in a place where it's all perfect? That's the model of high. Let's get high, where it's all perfect. It's all perfect. Spill the Coca-Cola, perfect. Somebody falls down in front of you and you say, karma. It's a very cold place. It's a very impersonal place. But it's a very safe place. Nuclear bomb may fall. Right. Well, all lawful. You're just seeing form lawfully manifest wherever you go. And it's all just doing perfect. But you see, when you come down at the human level, the amount of suffering is so painful to see it, to stay open, to keep your heart open to the suffering in the world, is so painful that you finally have to close your heart down. Or you either close your heart down to function down there, or you go up. Those are the really two choices you have. You either sort of burn out by closing down. That's what most, like, nurses and doctors do, that have to face suffering and death each day, or people that work in things where there's just so much suffering you can't even begin to conceive of ending it. No matter how hard you work, it just closes down a little bit. You just close your heart down a little bit. But that's the way it is. You just can't bear it. Or else you go up into that just karma, impersonal thing. Those are the kind of options you have. Because how do you begin on the human plane to handle all the suffering? You go to fix that one, put your finger in that hole in the dike, and that one's leaking. And you go to do that one, and that one's leaking. And where do you even begin? And I'm sure you are all in the good guy mailing list just like I am. And I sit with pen poised over checkbook. Well, is it going to be the whales? Is it going to be the battered children? Is it going to be the nuclear movement? Is it going to be the Democratic congressman? Is it going to be the children of Biafra? Is it going to be the Cambodian refugee camps? You know, who's suffering more? And everyone is saying, we are the key one. And you see that you can't possibly deal with all the suffering. And for me, for many years, I thought the game was to get high and get rid of my down. Because when I got high, I was one with the universe. I felt it was all so clear. It was so light. It was, and all the stuff that brought me down, I would put over there. And I would divide the world into that which kept me high and that which brought me down. And I'd say, can't go home and visit the folks. They bring me down. I started to have these little categories in life. Can't work in the world. Business money brings me down. You know, and it was all these things that bring you down. And I suffered from what you could call vertical schizophrenia. I mean, I even had two names for it. It was Dick Albert. And then there was Ram Dass. And Ram Dass was saw everything as love and everybody as brothers and sisters, and it was all unfolding of the law. And down here as Dick Albert, he was greedy, lustful, frightened, neurotic, human. But no matter how hard I pushed, Dick Albert didn't go away. It was as if I theoretically knew that it was all one, but it was all one except for that stuff that I was pushing away. And somewhere along the line in the past 10 years, I saw that the game was not to get high. The game was to become free. And free meant you weren't standing anywhere. And free meant that you had to embrace your lows as well as your highs. And free meant that as long as you pushed away anything, it had you. It's like the minute you are not doing something, I'm not being Dick Albert, it's got you. And when it says that there is nowhere to stand in the spiritual journey, it means channel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Stand nowhere. There's nowhere where you are not, and there's nowhere where you are. And it's an interesting thing that the quieter you get, and the more you start to hear how it all is, including yourself, the less clearly are you manipulative about it. the more you try to hear your part in the dance. And understand the dance has meaning. It isn't an error. It's not like somebody screwed up. And if somebody hadn't screwed up, it would all be nice now. I mean, it's a particular class that we're going through a certain curriculum. It's not the be-all, end-all. It's a certain strata of reality in which certain kinds of opportunities for certain experiences are available. It's like Buddha, when you ask Buddha who we are, Buddha lists, has these wonderful lists. He has 5 hindrances, he's got 10 fetters, he's got, you know, 24 no-nos and 52 this is and that. I mean, the Sutta Magga is full of lists. But just taking the 5 hindrances to play with. He said, who we are, well, we've got lust and greed. That's just one, that isn't even 2. You can't say I have one of these but not the other. Lust and greed. He said, then the second one is hatred and ill will. The third one is agitation of mind. Fourth one are our old friends, sloth and torpor. And the fifth one is doubt. 5 hindrances. Now, if you were going to set up an intentional community, say, well, who we have in it? Well, let's have people with lust and greed, hatred and ill will, agitation, sloth and torpor and doubt. What do you think the community would end up like? This. This is it. This is the one we created. And people that have those kinds of attachments of mind take birth here. Because this is the place where the sandpaper is available to work through those things. Which means, from channel 4, from a soul's point of view, you now look at your human birth, just the way you got it, right now, just the way it is, and realize that you created it. What you are doing on Earth is you created a program for yourself. You created a curriculum. It's called Human 305, and until you finish that curriculum, we're going to send you back again and again and again. Like somebody comes to me and says, I hear you're living in New Mexico now, which isn't true, but they say, I hear you're living in Santa Fe. I want to come study with you because I have been living in New York and I can't stand it. And I say, well, I don't take on students, but in your case, I'll make an exception, and your first assignment as my student is to go live in New York for 2 years. Because New York is just New York. It's not doing anything. You're doing it to yourself through New York. New York is merely showing you your own attachments of mind. If there's something that you don't like or you love, that's in you. That is now there. It means you're attached to needs, desires, fears, aversions, etc. When do you lose it that it's a curriculum and get caught in the curriculum? When do you get caught in the forms and start to suffer? The minute you are attached to a form, you suffer. And the minute you deny form, that's an attachment. You hear it? You can't grab, you can't push away. You are, as the Bible says, you are in the world, but not of the world. And imagine now that you and I have taken birth specifically in order to awaken fully, to become free. And that the birth experience, the incarnation, is a series of experiences that we, back up, back here, have designed to help us awaken, to confront us with our attachment. You see, you and I each see a world that is a projection of our own attachments. I mean, you know this probably from psychology. And there is a statement, the truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. When you want something, you see only what you want. If you're hungry, you just see what's edible. And if you get hungry enough, everything becomes edible. Donner Party, for example. Now, how would it be possible to be in a human birth and still see what is true? You would have to extricate yourself from attachment to your desires. But as a separate entity, you have desires. You're part of a species that must reproduce, must survive. You have desires to survive, desires to reproduce. You have desires for security and stability, desires for pleasure. Does this mean you have to give up these desires? No. I didn't say that. The game is to extricate your awareness from attachment or identification to the desire. The desires go on. They're there. The only point is you are no longer an identity with those desires. And you say, well, I can't imagine how that could be. But you're doing it all the time. Very often you are performing behavior that is satisfying various needs on your part, and yet your awareness is not caught in being the actor or being the getter of gratification, and yet you're doing it. For example, many of you find yourself hurtling through space, hopefully in a car, hurtling through space, guiding 3,000-4,000 pounds of metal, making incredibly complex decisions about centrifugal and centripetal force and inertia and things like that, all kinds of complex physics laws. And all the time you might be tuning the radio, looking for police, thinking about where you're going, remembering where you've been. You never even think about thinking about driving anymore. And you knew you think about driving. And then it goes on what we call base brain. It's just sort of happening. It's a very complex behavior. And you say, well, driving is one thing, but really, then there's important things I got to think about. Is that true? Question is there anything in life, is there any drama in life that is so seductive that it pulls you in where you lose your space? Where you lose that part of you that is not identified with a desire? As long as you see life as a set of choices about what it is you want out of life, it's very confusing. The moment you can identify with the soul and see life as a curriculum for awakening, then everything, shall I buy a new car or not? Well, how does that relate to my soul's awakening? And then you see, from that point of view, should I buy a new car or not? The answer, although most people don't want to hear it, doesn't matter. Because getting the new car is going to face me with certain learning experiences. Not getting the car is going to face me with new experiences. The people come to me and they say, should I get divorced or shouldn't I? I mean, they usually come with, should I get divorced or shouldn't I? I mean, with, you know, really juice. They've juiced it up. Now, when I say to them, you know, it doesn't matter. They don't want to hear that at all. Because they're in the world turns. They're really in there. They don't want to hear that space at all. But look at it. When you're at a choice point about any action, like should I marry or not, the part of you that, if you marry, the part of you that didn't want to marry is going to sit there. It's going to still be there. And if you don't marry, the part of you that wanted to marry is going to still be there. So you're going to have to work with that stuff either way, aren't you? From a point of view of awakening, you're going to awaken either way. And when you can stand back far enough into this space, you can see that all of your life experiences, independent of what they are all learning experiences. Then you say, well, then does it matter at all? Well, from a human point of view, it matters. From a soul's point of view, it doesn't matter. Because you're going to grow through all of it. So from a human point of view, you do your best to optimize pleasure, happiness, all of the nice things of life. From your soul's point of view, you take what comes down the pike. And because you have that perspective going simultaneously, You're not, if you're just in your human situation and you don't get what you want, you're really bummed out. If, on the other hand, you have this other perspective, you work to get what you want, and if you don't, work with what I got. And at first, you awaken out of your attachments, and then the attachments pull you back in, and then you are back wanting, desiring, fearing, hoping, yearning, etc. And then, as the process goes on, you start to develop that spaciousness of awareness, that presence, that open-heartedness, even as you are having these desires. For a long time, however, a desire will take over your consciousness. Uspensky, who was one of the students of Gurdjieff, wrote a book called In Search of the Miraculous. And he advocated a method called self-remembering, in which you sort of developed a witness, which was another part of you that noticed what you were doing. And he describes how he would experiment with himself, and he'd say, Uspensky is setting out for a walk. Uspensky is walking down the street. And Uspensky is turning left. And he would be very watching. Uspensky's lifting his left foot. Uspensky's lifting his right foot. And he was just watching all of it, witnessing it. And then he saw his tobacconist shop. And he remembered he needed pipe tobacco. And he lost it completely. 2 days later, he remembered he was doing an experiment. He just went under completely into the desire. The desire just took him over. And I think you can all feel that. You can feel where you're going along very spacious, very free, very loving, very open, and then something comes up that pulls you completely into your attachment, your fear, your yearning, like you go to church and you start to sing. And you're singing, Holy, Holy, Holy Lord God Almighty. And suddenly it all opens up, and there's the angels and the trumpets and the chariots and the whole mishpacha are all here. It's all here. And you look at everybody in the congregation. They're so beautiful, and they're my brothers and sisters. You love them. Your fourth chakra just opened. And you say, oh, I'm never going to change. I'm always going to feel this way. And it may last till dinner when somebody else gets the leg, something like that. At some moment, you pull back into your separateness in it. And the process of using your life experiences as a vehicle for awakening is to sit with that process. You babysit this process in yourself so that you see yourself get stuck. And then you see yourself come up for air, and you begin to notice what it is that sticks you, where you are clinging, which things grab your awareness. And very often, your awareness will be almost totally grabbed by something, but there'll be one little thread. It's like, I'll go into a depression, but there's a little part of me that's saying, boy, am I depressed. Now, the part of me that's noticing it isn't depressed. It's just noticing. The rest of me is depressed. And I want to make the distinction between what psychologists call dissociation as a mechanism of defense, where because something is so unpleasant, you push it away and stand back from it. And you say, look at all that depression. Doesn't matter to me. That's different. And that's often spirituality, or what you say I'm doing for a spiritual reason, is really a psychodynamic reason. You're really doing it in order to avoid the pain of living. You go up, or you go into that kind of, doesn't matter to me. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what it means to be in the world but not of the world, which means to stay open to the human condition, to your fear, longing, hopes, joys, arousals, depression, loneliness, self-pity, anger, jealousy, and at the same moment, simultaneously develop a spaciousness that surrounds it, just like sky surrounds clouds. And what you do at first to develop an appreciation of that part of you that isn't form, that isn't wanting, yearning, separate, needful, you do your methods. You do meditation, you do devotion, you do whatever you do. You do study, you come to retreats, you do these kind of things. And then, as your faith in that part of you gets stronger, you don't push away your human experiences as much. You dive into them more deeply. Till finally, when you look at a Zen monk that is really free, you see somebody that is richly living life. They're not sort of dallying on the side, sticking a toe in the water. It's to be in the world but not of the world. If you're going to get the lessons of life, you've got to live life, because the experiences are the ways you work through the attachments, not by avoiding the experiences. You don't avoid life and get free through it. Life is a series of experiences. You've got to be in them. Allow the risk of attachment and constantly be also connecting to this part that has nothing to do with the attachment. And you see all of your feelings and all of that is happening. It doesn't mean you're not experiencing them. But it means in addition to experiencing them, you are also cultivating a spaciousness. There is some quality of release from suffering the minute you can nurture in yourself that little bit of spaciousness. You can call it the cosmic giggle. You can call it anything you want. It has a certain humor to it. The humor that you've taken it all so seriously. I mean, how poignant we are. We get so lost in our melodrama. Are you always riding the waves, or are you sitting like a big tuna down in the ocean? Just sort of sitting there, looking up and saying, wow. Looking from this place where you're just undulating in space. A medium step in getting to that spaciousness, one of the methods is noticing all the stuff, noticing what catches you, what grabs you, in which you are separating part of your consciousness is the noticer and part of it is the desirer. Then, as you get further on, even the noticer disappears and there's just space. You're not busy self-consciously noticing. There's just spaciousness in the way you're doing it. Like I'm talking to you, same moment I'm not talking to you. And if you are quiet enough, if you're busy just being the listener, you're not meeting me in another place where we are just quietly hanging out together, watching the words come and go. And there's a certain type of listening. Like in the Tibetan tradition, Milarepa, the Tibetan yogi, is often pictured with his hand around his ear listening. It's like you listen your way into. It's not listening with your ear. It's just you become an instrument of tuning, in which you're tuning into more and more what is. It's like becoming part of the Tao, the way of things. And what I want to read you is an example of this. It's from a book called Mortal Lessons by a doctor named Seltzer. And these are his words. On the bulletin board in the front hall of the hospital where I work, there appeared an announcement. Yeshe Dondon, it read, will make rounds at 6 o'clock on the morning of June 10. The particulars were then given, followed by a notation. Yeshe Dondon is personal physician to the Dalai Lama. I am not so leathery a skeptic that I would knowingly ignore an emissary from the gods. Not only might such sang-froid be inimical to one's earthly well-being, it could take care of eternity as well. Thus, on the morning of June 10, I joined the clutch of white coats waiting in the small conference room adjacent to the ward selected for the rounds. The air in the room is heavy with ill-concealed dubiety and suspicion of bamboozlement. Imagine all these Western doctors. At precisely 6 o'clock, he appears, a short, golden, barrelly man dressed in a sleeveless robe of saffron and maroon. His scalp is shaven, and the only visible hair is a scanty black line above each hooded eye. He bows in greeting while his young interpreter makes the introduction. Yeshe Dondon, we are told, will examine a patient selected by a member of the staff. The diagnosis is as unknown to Yeshe Dondon as it is to us. The examination of the patient will take place in our presence, after which we will reconvene in the conference room where Yeshe Dondon will discuss the case. We are further informed that for the past 2 hours, Yeshi donned and has purified himself by bathing, fasting, and prayer. I, having breakfasted well, performed only the most desultory of ablutions and given no thought at all to my soul, glance furtively at my fellows. Suddenly we seem a soiled, uncouth lot. The patient had been awakened early and told that she was to be examined by a foreign doctor and had been asked to produce a fresh specimen of urine. So when we enter her room, the woman shows no surprise. She has long ago taken on that mixture of compliance and resignation that is the face of chronic illness. This was to be but another in an endless series of tests and examinations. Yeshi donned and steps to the bedside while the rest stand apart watching. For a long time, he gazes at the woman, favoring no part of her body with his eyes, but seeming to fix his glance at a place just above her supine form. I, too, study her. No physical sign nor obvious symptom gives a clue to the nature of her disease. At last, he takes her hand, raising it in both of his own. Now he bends over the bed in a kind of crouching stance, his head drawn down into the collar of his robe. His eyes are closed as he feels for her pulse. In a moment he has found the spot, and for the next half hour, he remains thus, suspended above the patient like some exotic golden bird with folded wings, holding the pulse of the woman beneath his fingers, cradling her hand in his. All the power of the man seems to have been drawn down into this one purpose. It is palpitation of the pulse raised to the state of ritual. From the foot of the bed where I stand, it is as though he and the patient have entered a special place of isolation, of apartness about which a vacancy hovers and across which no violation is possible. After a moment, the woman rests back upon her pillow. From time to time, she raises her head to look at the strange figure above her, then sinks back once more. I cannot see their hands joined in a correspondence that is exclusive, intimate, his fingertips receiving the voice of her sick body through the rhythm and throb she offers at her wrist. All at once, I am envious, not of him, not of Yeshi Donden for his gift of beauty and holiness, but of her. I want to be held like that, touched so, received. And I know that I, who have palpitated 100,000 pulses, have not felt a single one. At last, Yeshi Donden straightens, gently places the woman's hand upon the bed and steps back. The interpreter produces a small wooden bowl and two sticks. Yeshi Donden pours a portion of the urine specimen into the bowl, proceeds to whip the liquid with the two sticks. This he does for several minutes until a foam is raised. Then, bowing above the bowl, he inhales the odor three times. He sets down the bowl and turns to leave. All this while he has not uttered a single word. As he nears the door, the woman raises her head and calls out to him in a voice at once urgent and serene, "Thank you, doctor," she says, and touches with her other hand the place he had held on her wrist, as though to recapture something that had visited there. Yeshi Donden turns back for a moment to gaze at her, then steps into the corridor. Rounds are at an end. We are seated once more in the conference room. Yeshi Donden speaks now for the first time in soft Tibetan sounds that I have never heard before. He has barely begun when the young interpreter begins to translate, the two voices continuing in tandem, a bilingual fugue, the one chasing the other. It is like the chanting of monks. He speaks of winds coursing through the body of the woman, currents that break against barriers, eddying. These vortices are in her blood, he says, the last spendings of an imperfect heart. Between the chambers of her heart, long, long before she was born, a wind had come and blown open a deep gate that must never be opened. Through it charged the full waters of her river as the mountain stream cascades in the springtime, battering, knocking loose the land and flooding her breath. Thus he speaks and is silent. May we now have the diagnosis, the professor asks. The host of these rounds, the man who knows, answers, congenital heart disease, interventricular septal defect with resultant heart failure. A gateway in the heart, I think, that must not be opened. Through a charge, the full waters that flood her breath. So here then is the doctor listening to the sounds of the body to which the rest of us are deaf. He is more than doctor, he is priest. Once you can appreciate that there are other parts of your being from which the universe is heard differently, and that when you rest in these other parts of your being, you hear clearly, and then can understand the meaning of your manifestation and how to function within it, then the stance you adopt is that of someone who's listening. Tuning. It's like tuning an instrument. You're tuning and listening, to what is.